Blog Talk Radio.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and tonight's guest will be Dr. Umar Johnson, as we talk about the family and what's going on with our kids, homosexuality, and the likes. We're going to start off by saying we are offering our free articles as usual. The 14th Amendment Exposed, the Commerce Game, and how to play, and whether or not you even own your kids. And you access that by simply contacting me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com. And once again, I'd like to encourage you, if you have Twitter, if you have MySpace, if you own Black Planet, look me up over there. And if you have a Facebook page, of course, send me your friend request, and I will honor that, and that will give you access to my wall. That will also give you access to Tahaka's Institute. And in Tahaka's Institute, that's where we are placing all of your printed articles. I've just put a general durable power of attorney document there that you can run your copy off of it and fix it up so it will apply to you. And that will work anywhere inside the United States. Also, there's other information that you can use that's being placed there. When you're dealing with your bill collectors, when you're dealing with your bank, when you're dealing with the mortgage company, when you're dealing with the courts, the police department, state officials, and so on and so forth. And also, we've created one of the most comprehensive libraries inside the United States, and the way you access that is simply by contacting me at area code 904-303-9061, and we'll discuss that and get any subsequent information to you. I see we have a call on the line. I'm going to open it up and see if that's our guest. Area code 215. Let's see. Area code 215, would you please state your name and tell us where you're calling from?
Yes, good evening. This is Dr. Umar Johnson.
Dr. Umar Johnson, welcome, my brother. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Okay, we're just getting started. I just opened up, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to, before you begin to cut loose for us, brother, because I know you got a whole lot of heavy information that you're going to drop on us this evening. I've listened to you over and over and over, been on YouTube, been on everywhere, And, of course, we appreciate you coming down here in Jacksonville, Florida, and teaching the brothers and sisters down here. We certainly appreciate that. Every time you come here, you do such a wonderful job. And I just want to say thank you for traveling down here, helping our people out. I'm going to run a quick clip, and that clip should last approximately 7 minutes and 6 seconds, and after that, we are ready to go. Okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, here we go.
Peace, Black Power. We got the great doctor and brother Umar Johnson up here. I want to thank Ross Simeon and Tassetti Studios for blessing us with this brother up here. I got one question for you, brother, because this seems to be an epidemic that's running rampant up here in Syracuse, New York. Why do black men, not black men, Negro men, date white women?
Very good question. One thing we have to understand when we talk about interracial relationship is we have to study the self-hatred that the black man has for himself. We often hear the counter-argument that black men marry white women because they fell in love with them. It was a random act of romance. That's not true. When you look below the surface, you will find that 98% of all interracial marriages in America are middle-class to upper-class black men and middle-class to lower-class white women. You will find that the white woman tends to gain socially and economically through her marriage with the black man, and the black man doesn't gain anything except marriage to a white woman. Rarely will you ever find a rich white woman marrying a poor black man. So this has nothing to do with love, because if it was random acts of romance, then you would find rich white women with poor black men. You never see that. You only see working class or middle class black men with white women who are not of the same social stature. Frantz Fanon, black psychiatrist who wrote the book Black Skin, White Mask, he dealt eloquently with this issue. Although he himself was married to a white woman, he did admit that black men marry white women because they want acceptance from the white race. A black man who marries a white woman doesn't believe that a black woman is good enough for him. He has internalized the racist white supremacist views that Europeans have of African people. And as far as he's concerned, a black woman can't do anything but shine his shoes. He believes that he would be better suited with a white woman because by being with the white woman, his inferiority complex in the presence of the white man is somehow dainted, because now he has a white woman just like the white man has a white woman. So most black men who marry white women have low self-esteem. And the reason they marry the white woman is because they believe that by marrying her, they will feel a little bit more equal to white men. But here's the issue, and I don't say this to be disrespectful. I say it because it's the truth. The white women who black men marry, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the white women who black men marry are the white women that no other white man wanted. And this is something that no one wants to deal with. If a white woman could have a white man who had the money of the black man she married to, then she would be with the white man. No white woman is going to marry Tiger Woods if she can have Donald Trump, okay? She's not going to marry any black man if she can have a white man who's in a much better place financially. They tend to get the white women that other white men didn't want. And I don't say that to be disrespectful. It's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have a situation where a lot of black women are now dating white men. Again, you are only marrying the white men that other white women didn't want. And we have to recognize this. There's no white man that's going to marry a black woman if he could have married someone with the same education and income-earning potential from his own racial stock. Why we have to stop doing this is because when you bring a biracial child into the world, who I do consider to be African, being a Garveyite, but there are some contradictions within them because they belong to two races who are at opposite ends of the racial spectrum. And so when you have a mother who's black and a father who's white, or a father who's black and a mother who's white, that puts you at a position of cognitive dissonance. You don't really know where you stand. Now, your white relatives will never accept you as European, but you don't feel that you quite fit in with your black ones, and a lot of times our biracial brothers and sisters are picked on, humiliated, they're isolated. So to cut down on all of this nonsense, we got to have black men marrying black women and black women marrying black men. There is no benefit to African people by having so many of our black men those who are most educated, those who are most financially stable, to be going outside of the race. It is nothing more than a example of self-hatred. Let me say this in closing. Black men marry outside of their race more than the men of every other race put together. Black men marry white women more than Chinese men, white men, Asian men, Indian men marry black women. We are the only man in this country who is more willing to marry outside of his race than in his race. Certainly you will see Chinese men, you will see white men, you will see East Indian men marry outside of their race, but not to the extent that black men do it. In 1967, there was a Supreme Court case called Loving versus Virginia. In Loving versus Virginia, a white man sued all the way up to the United States Supreme Court for a right to marry a black woman. And as a result of that, the Supreme Court eliminated all anti-miscegenation laws in the country. From 1967 to 2011, from 1967, when the Supreme Court struck down anti-miscegenation law, to today, black men have outpaced the men of every other race in their desire to marry women who are not African. It is nothing more than another case of self-hatred.
Beautiful. And I just want to add just one thing to that. As somebody who is a half-breed, a dignified bastard that I like to look at myself as, Dr. Umar, I don't give white folks no opportunity. I don't give them no chance. I will drag.
Okay, Brother Johnson,
yes, sir.
I think that was well put, and I'm 58 years old, and I think your delivery on that particular message was the most complete and detailed delivery I have ever heard. A lot of times I think a lot of people want to say a lot of different things, but they just can't say it. But I don't feel like, you have done a fantastic job in regards to bringing this information to us about why black men date and marry white women and vice versa. In regards to that, is there anything else that we need to know involving that particular situation that you want to give us live?
Well, one of the most important things that we have to recognize right now as the war against African people continues is that basically there's only two types of marriages that are acceptable or that are of interest to our enemy, and that is either a homosexual relationship or a biracial relationship. In fact, when you look at most of the new black couples, most of the new black couples in our community, you will see that they are either gay couples, homosexual couples, lesbian couples, transgender couples, bisexual couples, or they are biracial couples. There is a war against the traditional black family structure, and that war is trying to replace that structure with homosexual marriage and with biracial marriage.
Yeah, I see. And this is all directed at the destruction of the basic unit of society among the black nation, and that is to attack the family. And we know that procreation between the sexes is responsible for the continuation of that particular species. So what you are telling me is that this particular type of attack stops us from growing any further. I mean, if this type of thing continues, we will be at something like almost zero population growth. And I know that's the goal. Okay,
yes,
I'm in agreement with that. Okay, because I know you mentioned homosexuality. Let's get down in it. Could you give us some background on that? Because a lot of people say people are born homosexuals and this stuff, but I don't fly with me. I mean, I've studied our culture and our story. I've also studied his story in regards to African stuff, and that just never presented itself. Could you give us some background information on the homosexuality thing?
Very much so. A couple of facts. Number one, there is no conclusive evidence that anyone on Earth is born homosexual or lesbian. There is speculation, but there is no conclusive evidence. In fact, a few years ago, the American Psychological Association revised its official position on homosexuality to reflect that fact. They concluded that although there is research currently underway to investigate biological causes of homosexual and lesbian behavior, to date, there is no definitive finding on the topic. So that's fact number one. There's no conclusive proof. Fact number two, most of the research that is being done to try to fabricate evidence to suggest that homosexuality and lesbianism is natural is being paid for by population control junkies and also by homosexual movements. Remember, whenever a problem is created for African people, your first question should be, who benefits the most from us participating in this behavior? Who benefits the most from us participating in this behavior? Please be clear. Fact number three, please be clear. The homosexual movement is a population extermination movement. The reason homosexuality is being pushed is to eliminate Africans off the face of the earth through their own consent by way of homosexual and lesbian behavior. It's real simple. Take the 2 billion Africans living on earth right now. If all 2 billion of us decided to only cohabitate with someone who is of the same gender, if all the men decided to only have sex with other men, and if all the women decided to only have sex with other women, where would the next generation of Africans come from? It wouldn't.
Nowhere.
You will automatically die out by virtue of your homosexual behavior. Remember, fact number four, up until April of 1974, when the American Psychiatric Association printed the sixth volume of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, Volume 2. This is the Bible of Psychology and Psychiatry. Everything we diagnose is contained in that book. Right now, we're functioning under DSM-4, but it was DSM-2, sixth printing, April of 1974, for the first time in American history, homosexuality was no longer considered a mental disorder. It has only been legal for 37 years.
Wow. That is fantastic delivery of information. I think we need to start waking up to this type of information, because this is not a game. And the people that are fostering this stuff on us and are attacking our family structure this way, they are, in my opinion, they're doing so because, number one, we as people with high concentrations of carbon that they are calling melanin, we represent a threat genetically. So that would seem to be a direct attack against our procreation. And that there's just no other way that I can see it. Dr. Francis Crest Wilson has stated that they circumvented the globe and they noticed that everyone on the planet was persons of color except for them. And we know that in school, we were taught that black is dominant and white is recessive, meaning weak. And so it makes all the sense in the world to me why this type of attack is going on. And I don't think it stops there. I think it goes even further from there. What about our children? What about the young black males? Could you elaborate on that for us, please?
Remember this. Adolf Hitler, who was a propaganda control genius, said that with the right information, you could make a people living in hell think they live in heaven. And you can make a people living in heaven think they live in hell. the primary responsibility of public education is to socialize the children into the mindset that is most conducive for the perpetuation of the American social order. The goal of school is to teach black children what to think, not how to think. It's also to socialize them into the behaviors that are most conducive for the perpetuation of the American social order's agenda. So black children are being hoodwinked and brainwashed, okay, and seduced into homosexual behavior. The state of California 3 months ago passed America's first mandatory homosexual curriculum. New York City schools currently is infusing homosexual curriculum into the social studies course. You're seeing an entire wave, an entire movement of homosexual education into the public schools, which began the same year that homosexuality was made normal. The actual vote took place in 1973, but the DSM in 74 was the first one to have homosexuality omitted. In the same year, 1974, the year I was born, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger penned the National Security Memorandum 2000, whose sole focus was population control. In that document, he suggested, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, that students be taught sex education in schools to help reduce the burgeoning population explosion. We didn't know that sex education courses were only a code word for the homosexual education courses that we are now being faced with today. We thought that they were only going to be teaching children about how babies are made and delivered. We thought that they were only going to be advocating against teenage pregnancy. We thought that they were going to be teaching our children how to use condoms so they didn't catch sexually transmitted diseases. So we bought into the situation because we were co-opted with propaganda. But that's not the purpose of sex education. The purpose of sex education is to induce and influence your child to participate in a life of having sex with someone who has the same genital organs that they have.
Okay. Wow. And that all coincides and pairs up with the eugenics movement here in the United States and abroad. Could you give us a little bit of information on that, please?
Oh, very much so. The eugenics movement actually grew out of white psychology. There was a European by the name of whose name is escaping me at present, but he was the cousin to Charles Darwin. Francis Galton. Francis Galton was his name. He was the cousin to Charles Darwin, and he stated that it would be important for Europeans to separate themselves from other people and also gradually bring about the extermination of other people who they considered to have a gene pool or genotype that could possibly affect or downgrade or denigrate the European stock. The word eugenics means good stock. It means good stock. The movement of eugenics is selective breeding, the selective breeding of whites and the selective breeding of other people for the benefit of whites, but ultimately for racial extermination. The whole concept of social segregation, the whole concept of keeping white people away from black people is based on eugenics. It basically says if we allow them to come amongst us, they're going to cohabitate with us, and by doing that, our pure white blood will be contaminated and it will be brought down. Eugenicists believe that crime, murder, they believe that unemployment, laziness, they believe that all social behaviors are genetically derived. Now, of course, there's absolutely no proof for this, but it is a very effective pseudoscientific piece of propaganda, because if you can convince the world that black men are born to be violent, if you can convince the world that black women are born to be lazy, which are all stereotypes, if you can convince the world that these are genetic predispositions, then the world will support you in exterminating African people, because after all, having a world without African people is mutually beneficial to all other races. And we have to recognize that we do not have a friend in any race. We are the only friend we got, and we need to stop trying to hold hands with Arabs, with East Indians, with Native Americans, with Europeans. We need to stop holding hands with other people, because at the end of the day, every other race sees us exactly as the white man sees us, and that is a people who should be marked for extermination.
Wow. Okay. Man, that's this thing here, man, is I don't think many people understand that we're so caught up in the everyday activities and going back and forth and trying to make a living that we just don't get a chance, haven't taken the time to look at ourselves collectively as a nation and look at the overall conditions of people of African descent inside this, on this landmass, and what's going on, because this thing here is very, very serious. And people like yourself and myself, and there are many others out here on the front line trying to expose this information as best we can. And I think that it is time for people to start acting differently, because if we don't, we're going to end up in some very, very serious trouble here. Could you now we dealt with the black men and black women marrying white men and white women. But now, if we're going to be coming together and procreating among ourselves with the facts in mind that we are under attack through eugenics, our children are under attack in the school system, homosexuality is being fostered through the media, it's being signed off on in the White House and in all these other places. There are some things that we need to correct. And I listened to one of your broadcasts involving six types of women that we should leave alone. And I'm pretty sure that you have some stuff involving the men as well. But could you give us some elaboration on that so that we can have that information on our belt as well?
Very much so. First of all, we have to recognize something. The war against white supremacy, white domination, is primarily a psychological war. If you notice, the white man rarely has to fight his victims. Very rarely does he go to war. He may have went to war in Afghanistan. He may have went to war in Kuwait. He may have went to war in Iraq, Libya, the Somalia campaign of 1993. But most of the time, he doesn't have to fight. Remember, the European is only 10% of the world, but he dominates the other 90% rather effectively without fighting. Why? Because the first frontier of any military campaign is the psychological ground, which means that if you can induce a people to quit before the fight even begins, if you can intimidate them, if you can put enough anxiety, worry, panic, and psychological terrorism into that group, you don't have to go to war. As all great military strategists have known, if you can make the mind fall, then the troops will automatically follow. And I'm bringing that up to say this. Many of our black children are predisposed to lose the war against white supremacy because many of them don't have the psychological strength to put up with what they're going to face once they leave their mothers' and fathers' homes. This is a very realistic issue because of the domestic violence, the rape, the incest, the molestation, the fatherlessness, the motherlessness, the over-incarceration, the sibling rivalry, the peer abuse. Because our children have such a difficult time growing up in their homes, many of them are going to go out into the white world already suffering from some sort of a mental illness or emotional instability that the enemy will be able to exploit and bring about a quick psychological victory, which prevents the actual physical battle. So when we look at our relationships, we have to recognize that too many of us are getting married for the wrong reasons, too many of us are cohabitating for the wrong reasons, too many of us are having children for the wrong reason. I find in my work that one of the biggest reasons why black people are getting married is because they can't stand to be by themselves. In other words, they have a very terrible relationship with the one person they have to be with for the rest of their lives, and that is themselves. The reason why many of us run out looking for a partner is because being alone is too painful. It is too lonely, and it is too uncomfortable. And the reason why it is painful, lonely, and uncomfortable is because while you are with yourself, your unconscious mind automatically brings to the surface issues, problems, and unresolved conflicts going all the way back to your childhood that you still have not resolved, whether it was incest, whether it was fatherlessness, whether it was low self-esteem, whether it was lack of motivation. Maybe it was weight loss. Maybe it was not finishing your degree, never going into business for yourself, the terrible relationship you had with your mother, the terrible relationship you had with your older brother, your younger sister. These are all problems, complexes and conflicts that we have within ourselves, and many of us reach for a relationship to do what? Distract us from our pain. In other words, the black romantic relationship serves the same purpose as a pack of cigarettes, as a blunt, as a shot of heroin, cocaine, crack, or opium. It is simply a drug, a pacifier to save us from ourselves.
Okay. Dr. Johnson, let me ask you something. You have a lot of this information that you are telling us tonight. You have this stuff on a DVD disc. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Is it possible that our listeners could get a hold of this information somewhere? You have a website that you're doing this for?
Yes,
I do.
My web. Yes. The
ahead.
Website is Dr. Umar Johnson. .com. That's D as in destiny, R as in redemption, U as in unity, M as in mankind, A as in African, R as in redemption, Johnson, JOHNSON.com. Or my website is a list of my products. You can download the list of products, email me what you like. I'll send you a PayPal link. I also have a calendar you can click on and see where I'll be speaking. I will be speaking tomorrow and on Friday in Memphis, Tennessee. So if you have any listeners from Memphis, Tennessee, there will be a reception for me tomorrow night at the Java Juice and Jazz Restaurant at 1423 Elvis Presley Boulevard from 6 to 8 tomorrow, which is Thursday. And then on Friday, I'll be doing two sessions, one of them from 11 to 1 and another from 5 to 8. We're going to deal with post-traumatic slavery disorder. We're also going to deal with the psycho-academic war against black boys. And on Saturday, December 31st, I'll be having a New Year's Eve lecture at the Nation of Islam Temple in Knoxville, Tennessee. That's Knoxville, Tennessee, New Year's Eve, where I will be talking about the war against African people, the need to awaken from the psychological matrix.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you all heard that. The same stuff that Brother Umar Johnson is teaching us here this evening, you can get through his website and his speaking engagements in various parts of the United States. He has also appeared here in Jacksonville, Florida, on more than one occasion. And every time he's here, I'm the one that sits right up in front, on the front row, so I don't miss a thing. And I certainly appreciate you coming down here, and we're looking forward to your return. And we will turn out to listen and learn from you and also support your efforts in bringing this type of information out, because it is vital, because we are in a critical hour. Now, I noticed that you mentioned the psychological war against our black boys. Is there anything else that's going on that you haven't mentioned in regards to our children that you think that we need to know? What steps should we be taking now to curb what's going on?
Well, we must bear in mind that there's five stages in the psycho-academic war against black children and black young men in particular. There is miseducation. The three goals of miseducation are to teach the black boy to hate himself, to love white culture, and if possible, to effeminize or homosexualize him. We have to keep in mind that schools are primarily socialization institutions, and the chief goal of socialization for black males in the 21st century is to homosexualize them. If you can't homosexualize them, you at least strive to effeminize them. And stage two is psychiatric medication. When a black boy refuses to have his spirit broken, he is automatically put on dangerous chemical brain drugs to force his mind to do what his spirit refused to do. If the brain drugs are not successful in breaking the spirit of the young black boy, then they put him in juvenile incarceration, where he's going to serve for months or years until he agrees to submit to the social order. And if that's not successful, he is simply rejected from the American social order. He's not given an opportunity to earn a diploma, to go to college, or to work at a livable wage job. This leads to psychological frustration and alienation on the part of the black male, which culminates in stage five, which is premature mortality, suicide, or homicide, usually at the hands of another black male suffering and victimized from the same social order.
Okay. All right. Now, notice you have spoken on ADHD. Is that a mental disorder? Is that a social disorder? What's going on with that? And the vaccination? Because I notice every time I look around, they're coming out that we need to vaccinate our children, and then they have these. Well, it's flu season. You need to get your flu shots and all of this stuff. Could you elaborate on the ADHD thing and the vaccines?
Sure. The ADHD is one of the biggest mental medical hoaxes that has ever been pushed over on black people. The drug companies who publicly trade on Wall Street gross about $50 billion a year brain drugging black boys into oblivion. ADHD, so-called disorder, is nothing more than the constant complaining of middle-class white teachers who don't want to be bothered with black boys, thereby forcing their mothers to take them down to the psychiatrist and get a prescription so they can sit still long enough to be miseducated. I totally disagree with the diagnosis. I have yet to meet a child who truly exemplified what I consider to be abnormal inattention or hyperactivity. Most of the boys who are taking these medicines are being prescribed these medicines almost purely on the recommendation of a white classroom teacher who could care less about the child and doesn't have a single bit of mental health training whatsoever. It is nothing but a new Tuskegee experiment. It is an experiment being run on black boys to see what the long-term effects will be on that population of giving them dangerous adult psychiatric medicines. It was not until the year 2000, at the turn of the current century, that the Food and Drug Administration passed a regulation that said you can now give children adult psychiatric medication. Up until the year 2000, it was difficult, not that it was impossible, but it was difficult to give children adult psychiatric medication. Now you can. The average brain doesn't stop growing until you are approximately 30 years of age. It continues to expand and the neurons continue to develop, but the brain begins to slow in its growth at 30. So if you're giving a 5 or 6 year old black boy psychiatric medication, okay, at 5, 6, and 7, and the brain doesn't stop growing until age 30, you have no idea of the type of organic brain disturbances and dysfunctions that you are creating until well after you stop giving them the drug. We also have to recognize that these drugs that they give our children are no different than the illegal street drugs that they are locking black men up for. This is the total hypocrisy of the miseducation and incarceration movement, because in the miseducation branch of this movement, you're giving children drugs that bring about the same side effects that the illegal drugs bring about, but yet you're locking up the fathers of these young men for selling the drugs on the street, the very same drugs that you're giving to their sons in the school. This is ridiculous. It is the greatest civil rights crime taking place right now. It is a gross neglect of basic human rights, and I think that the black community should be ashamed of itself for standing by and let our children get special educated, medicated, homosexualized, and miseducated. It is a shame, and the responsibility is not only on the shoulders of our enemy, but it's on our shoulders for doing nothing. And let me also say this briefly. It's about to get worse. Why is it about to get worse? Because in 2013, March of 2013, please mark your calendar, the American Psychiatric Association will be publishing the DSM-5. A few minutes ago, I told you that the DSM-2 removed homosexuality, which was considered an illness until April of 1974. Well, guess what? They're at it again, folks. When the DSM-5 is published in March of 2013, there's a special committee for the removal of pedophilia, for the removal of pedophilia out of the DSM-5. There's a group of psychiatrists who are working ardently to have pedophilia removed from the DSM-5 because they no longer believe that having sexual attraction for a child is an illness. So in another year and a half, it may very well be a reality that it is no longer considered a sickness to want to have sex with children.
Okay, now if such a thing takes place, how will that spill over into the courts in the event? How will that manifest itself in the court system in the event that someone is a victim of something like that? How would that manifest itself?
It's going to make it more difficult to bring suit against someone who's responsible for molesting children, because once the American Psychiatric Association decides that something is no longer a mental disorder, it then paves the way for that behavior to become a normal part of the culture, such as is what happened with homosexuality. So in 37 years, you've seen homosexuality become totally accepted in American culture, because whenever you remove a behavior that is sick and now you call it normal, you automatically legitimize that behavior as being acceptable. So if they are successful in removing pedophilia out of the DSM, and I have strong reason to believe that they will be, if they are successful, then that paves the way for pedophilia to no longer be considered a crime, which means that it will be more difficult to prosecute, which means that pedophilia as a felony may only be considered pedophilia as a misdemeanor. And you have to remember that white folk have a cultural history of having sex with boys. I am not saying that all white men and women condone, uphold, or practice pedophilia or homosexual behavior. But we have to be clear, pedophilia and homosexual behavior has its root in Greco-Roman culture. It has its roots in Greco-Roman culture. And during that period, many of the men who were homosexual were also pedophilia. Not only did they want to have sex with males, they wanted to have sex with boys. So we should not be surprised to see that this behavior is becoming normal. What did the Pope say? Not too long ago, the recent Pope stated that it was normal at one time for men to have sex with boys. And that's why the Roman Catholic Church leads the world in pedophilia convictions, because this is a part of their culture. The problem is it's not a part of our culture, but many black people are afraid to stand up and speak out against it because they're being told by their so-called black president, President Obama, and other black bourgeoisies that they have to accept this behavior because homosexuals are minorities just as they are. So they are confusing the agenda and the identity of black people so that we will support this filth and decadence.
I see. Okay, so and what you're saying here in regards to the President of the United States is that he's not making an all-out effort to stop this homosexuality thing, stop this situation inside the school systems that's attacking our children, but he's doing something else. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, not only is he not stopping it, brother, he's promoting it. President Obama has done more for homosexuals in 3 years than he's ever done for black people in his entire political career. In fact, homosexuals have made more progress in 3 years than black people have made in 300 years. I want to be clear. President Obama is not standing on the sidelines, Brennan. He is an active supporter, an advocate of laws and policies that support and allow this type of behavior. The Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, who was handpicked by President Obama, is the same person who fought for an all-homosexual high school in Chicago, which stands today. The gay children of Chicago have their own school. This is the man who Obama put in charge of your child's education. He also put in charge of safe and drug-free schools Kevin Jennings, who is the European who said that he wanted a mandatory homosexual curriculum in every school in his country. So Obama, without a doubt, is the homosexual president.
Wow, that is unbelievable. But I'm pretty sure I have seen him say a few things, but I haven't been watching him closely. But I'm certainly glad that you brought this information out to the table so that we can start paying more attention to what's going on. Well, let's deal with some things that we can do. Do we have, and I'm pretty sure that the attacks against the black boys and stuff in the educational system is probably happening more in the public school system. Do we have any alternatives, or what is our best alternatives in protecting our children in the school system? What can we do? What type of schools are available to us?
Well, we have to build our own. There's no school in this country that I have seen that properly prepares African children to compete on a global level. Let's keep in mind what the function of education is to begin with. The function of education is to teach a child how to acquire and maintain power for his people, period. To acquire and maintain power for his people, period. Let's take a look at Cecil John Rhodes, the white imperialist, the British Anglo-Saxon who went into South Africa and murdered millions of Africans to take over the diamond mines. In his last will and testament, he bequeathed funds for the development of the Rhodes Scholarship. The purpose of the Rhodes Scholarship is to train white men to ensure that Anglo-Saxon supremacy remains for all eternity. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. The problem is that Europeans use their acquisition of power and control to destroy other people. But the goal of education for all people on earth should be absolutely the same, to acquire and to maintain power. The problem is we do not teach black children to acquire and maintain power. We teach black children to work for the people who are in power. So a black child is never thinking ownership. That's why we don't own any businesses. We don't teach our children to think ownership. We teach them to think servantship. In other words, we want them to be glorified slaves. They might have their doctorate. They might have a nice car. They might have a nice house. They might make $500,000 a year, but they are still a servant to the master class because we are teaching them to serve the people in power, not to take or acquire that power for themselves. So our entire approach to education for our children has to take an immediate about-face, a total 365-degree transition if we are to come out from under oppression. The Chinese man, the Arab, the East Indian, and the European are fighting for global supremacy while the black boy and girl are simply being taught by their community to serve whoever wins that global fight. Build your own schools.
Okay. Well, what about this thing with the brothers and sisters that are in positions inside the United States to make large sums of money, like your athletes, your professional football players, professional basketball players, television talk show personalities, people that's making hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of dollars. What kind of situation are they in? Are they doing anything to deal with the plight of the black nation, in your opinion?
Not only in my opinion, but let's look at the facts of their behavior. Rich black people, historically, have never done anything for black people because they are paid excessive amounts of money to ensure that they stay away from grassroots activism. Remember, in a white supremacist system, any role you play within the structure is automatically going to help maintain that structure. So when black people get rich within a white supremacist structure, there are rules and guidelines as to how they can behave. These rules are unwritten. They don't have to be spoken because they are fully evidenced in the behavior of the previous generation of black rich people. So the young brother who's going to be a millionaire tomorrow has already been trained by the current generation of black millionaires how to behave. And one of the first things that you're supposed to keep in mind as a black person is that you're never supposed to be seen participating in any grassroots struggle, nor should your money ever find its way to any grassroots struggle. That's why the average rich black person stays as far away from the black community as they possibly can. That's why they give money to United Way. They give money to the YMCA. They give money to the Boys and Girls Club. They give money to the Roman Catholic Church. They give money to all of these white 501c3 nonprofit organizations. But yet and still you have black organizations struggling to make ends meet, people working, enslaving to help pay people, not earning one red cent, and they won't even drop off a dollar. Why? Because they know to do so would earn the rebuke of white people. And it is difficult to stay rich in America as a black person when you piss off white people because you only got rich with their permission in the first place. We have this myth that to be rich is to be powerful. It's one of the greatest misconceptions in the black community. The richer you are, the more enslaved you are, unless you made your money off of your own people. Most rich black people did not get rich off of black dollars. They got rich off of white dollars. Whether it's Oprah Winfrey, whether it's your NBA, whether it's your NFL, these people got rich off of white patronage, white people watching those basketball games, white people going to the playoffs, white people watching the Oprah Winfrey show. Her number one audience was the middle-class white woman, not black people. So you got to remember, black people are made rich by white money, and those same white people who made them rich can make them poor.
I see. Now, this. So let me make sure I got this right. So these people here, they're sort of like locked away from helping their people unless they're going to be persecuted, in so many words of what you're saying. And I know that according to Dr. Francis Fred Wilson, we have the 9 points of the global system of white supremacy, which is economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war. Now, when it comes to entertainment, we know that Europeans control the media. They control the NBA. They control the ABA and all of these things. So what would be the consequences if some of these athletes or entertainers got together and said that, well, we're gonna break the rules and we're going to help our people as a nation?
If they collectively came together with support of the community, it would be difficult. It would be very difficult, social order, to destroy them. It would be very difficult. However, we know that the white boy plays rough and he plays dirty. And so when they stand up to say that we're standing together, they're going to have to mean it, because that white boy is going to cancel their contracts, cancel their endorsements. He's going to try to make them poor. And the only way we're going to be able to protect them from becoming poor is if we do what? Back them up and build our own independent basketball leagues, our own independent television news networks, our own independent football leagues. Here's the issue. We have the money to compete with the European. Let's not get it twisted. We have the money to compete with the European. The problem is we are disorganized. The Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey said the greatest weapon used against the Negro is disorganization. And until we become organized, financially organized, militaristically, politically, economically organized, we won't be able to get far. The white man has full faith in the black man's ability to destroy anything that's in the best interest of his people. He knows that we're going to work against our best interest because he trained us to be like this. 243 years of slavery, another 143 years of post-slavery Jim Crowism, the white man has thoroughly educated black people in the science of self-destruction. Our children go to white public schools for 180 days every school year. That's 180 days times 12 years of schooling. So when you do the math on that, a black child recites the Pledge of Allegiance thousands of times before he ever even gives a thought to the liberation of black people. Remember, whoever teaches your children controls your future. And if we want to control our own future, we're going to have to start teaching our children ourselves, because it is absolutely asinine to expect your children to come back home and work for the best interests of their community when from 8 a.m. until 3 p.m. they are trained in how to uplift the white supremacist community.
Okay, I see. So even though it would be difficult, I feel like, and this is just my personal opinion, I feel like based on the global system of white supremacy, and I feel like they're not their agenda don't just involve destroying the grassroots level of people of African descent. I feel like is all of us, including the rich ones, including the ones that sit on the Supreme Court, including the ones that are in the White House. Am I right in assuming that that's their position?
Yes, you're very correct. You're very correct. I just want to clarify your statement by adding that although their agenda is to exterminate all African people, because African people outnumber white people, they cannot exterminate us without our participation. And this is why the rich blacks and the black aristocracy become so useful to the purposes of racial oppression and control, because they use them to confuse and distract you while they're exterminating you. And so they get black people in high places to tell you that things are fine, things are getting better. Keep the faith. Keep fighting for integration. Support President Obama. And so you look at your immediate circumstances and you say, I'm catching hell ungodly, but I'm being told by successful black people that everything is all right. So that creates confusion. And whenever a person is confused, they simply stand still and do nothing. So, yes, they want to exterminate Oprah Winfrey. Yes, they want to exterminate LeBron James. Yes, they want to exterminate all these black actors. But they need them to help them first distract the masses. And once they have successfully exterminated the masses, then it will be no time before they can exterminate the black aristocracy who they used to distract the masses long enough to exterminate them. See, the problem is that well-placed black people think that white people treat them or see them in a totally different vein. They think that they belong to a special group of privileged blacks who white folks are not interested in destroying. That's because they don't understand white supremacy. White supremacy is not interested in only exterminating some black people. They're interested in exterminating all black people, and they only treat well certain black people because they need them in order to better control the others. For example, white police officers can't stand black police officers, but they tolerate them. Why? Because they need them in order to effectively control the rest of us. Our problem is we confuse diplomatic relationships with a true sense of friendship, and that's the problem. We get around white folk and we start hallucinating and buying into the fact that they're treating us good. They're not treating you good because they genuinely like you. They're treating you good because they know black people love to be accepted by white people. And so if all they need to do is smile in your face and shake your hand to win your trust, that's exactly what they will do, because they are willing to do anything whatsoever, include act like your friend, if it brings about an effective removal of your population.
Okay. I think that was very, very well put. Dr. Johnson, I have one more question, because I've read off the global system of white supremacy, and it did include religion. What about the sisters and the brothers inside of the churches? Because we have thousands upon thousands of churches all across the United States, and could you tell us how the global system, what part the global system of white supremacy plays in regard to the church and Christianity and religion?
Very much so. Let's keep in mind that when you study military science and when you study the conquering of nations by other nations, when you study colonization in Africa, colonization anywhere in the world, and colonization is nothing more than a certain type of a military campaign, you will find that the conqueror always seeks to control three institutions as soon as he invades and penetrates the land. First, he wants to control the church. Then he wants to control the school. Then he wants to control the military. But the church and the school are far more important than the military. You control the school, you control the minds of the future generations. If you control the church, you control the spirit of the future generation. And if you control the military, you control the body. So you automatically seek to do what? Dominate mind, body, and soul. mind, body, and soul, school, military, and the church. And so the church becomes the most important institution for the maintenance and perpetuation of white supremacy. Remember, the good Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., may he forever rest in peace, stated that the world is in greater peril, not from those who do evil, but from those who watch it and do nothing. And to see evil and do nothing is to make one just as guilty as if they committed the crime themselves. So you have millions of black people who sit by and say nothing about miseducation, say nothing about mass incarceration, say nothing about effeminization, say nothing about extermination. They don't say anything about this, okay? And they think that they are simply out of the issue. You cannot be a neutral party in any war in which you and your people are an active participant. So to be quiet is to give a silent consent to what the perpetrator is doing. So when you see all these actors and rich black people and entertainers say absolutely nothing about the black condition, they are giving silent consent to the agenda that's being perpetuated against African people. And we must make sure that we are clear that the church has always been the backbone of any community, be it black or any other race. The church has always been the backbone. When the church becomes a supporter of the American social order, then it makes that social order so much more successful in being able to be pushed against your people. And so until the black church stands back up, it's going to be difficult for black people to stand back up because we are a religiously immature people. We cannot think outside of Islam. We cannot think outside of Christianity. 75% of what most of us think about is somehow tied to our religious ideology. We're religiously immature. We're the only people who are like that. And as a result of that, white supremacy loves to use religion and allegory to keep us confused. And black people are the only group of people on earth who are forced to choose between their race and their religion. Nobody else has that problem. Black people do. You have to be a Muslim or you have to be black. You have to be a Christian or you have to be black. Why can't you be proud to be African and be a Muslim? Why can't you be proud to be African and be a Christian? Because the religions have been used as weapons against our consciousness, leading us to believe that to be proud in who God made you is some sort of a sin and that it's much more important to be proud of what you identify with, although your religion is based on belief, but your racial existence is based on a fact of nature. So why in the hell would you identify with the belief as opposed to a fact of nature that cannot be altered?
I see. Okay. So now let me ask you another church question. Because I see, and I live directly across the street from one of the largest church buildings inside the city of Jacksonville, Florida. And I know that the churches are filled with our people. And it seems to me it is the last gathering place for our people, and that should be the springboard. That should be they should be at the forefront of spearheading any effort to curtail the global system of white supremacy. In your opinion, would you say that people that are in charge of the churches, that's actually running the churches, are being held in pocket some kind of way by the European powers to be?
Oh, without a doubt. George W. Bush, the last president of the United States who directly preceded President Obama, he created the FBI, the new FBI, which is called the Faith-Based Initiative. And they started giving money to black churches in order to shut them up and pull them out of any sort of true grassroots work. So many of your black churches and masjids are taking money from the federal, city, state, local governments, which is effectively handcuffing them for participating in struggle. For example, you hardly find black churches who stand out against homosexuality. You hardly find them anymore. Why? What happened? Black churches used to be almost exclusively against that lifestyle. Not anymore. Why? Because they're being paid to accept it. They're being paid to accept it. You also have to keep in mind, a hopeless people who don't believe that they have power to change their condition will always resort to worship as opposed to work to get out of their condition. It has nothing to do with faith in God. It has nothing to do with us being a religious people. The reason why the churches are so filled up with black people is because black people feel powerless to change their conditions with their own two hands, so they have to do it by relying on Christ or Muhammad or God. It's not that we're more religious than other people. It's because we're more hopeless than other people. The church is the domain of the hopeless. And I'm not saying that everybody who goes to church is hopeless. I'm not saying that. But the truth of the matter is quite clear. Anybody who studies the pathology of religion knows that people always spend more time in the church than outside of the church when they feel that they are in a hopeless situation against which they can do nothing about it. And that's why ministers who are nothing but poverty and hopelessness pimps are able to successfully exploit the hopelessness of their constituency to get money out of their pocket. They're telling them they can pay their way to heaven, pay their way out of hell. But when they leave church, leave the mosque, they're in the same condition they were in before they walked in there. The problem with the church is that they take in so much money and don't do anything with it. How can you take in so much money and don't put nobody to work? How can you take in so much money and not have schools for our children? How can you take in so much money and not have institutions? I totally disagree with people who argue that the Jew is bleeding the black community more so than anybody else. The white Jew is not the number one bleeder of the black community, nor is it the Korean corner store. The number one financial bleeder of the black community is the megachurch minister who is pimping people's pockets and keeping them in poverty.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to say that I'm in absolute agreement with you in saying that based on what I have seen. I have lived in Texas. I've been all up and down the East Coast, all the way down to Miami, all over the United States, all up in the Tennessee mountains. And I have pretty much seen the same thing going on. And it's just so hard for me to swallow how, because I always look at things from a national standpoint because I follow certain basic principles. First I deal with me, then I deal with family, then community, and then nation. And I'm right here now dealing with nationhood because of the gigantic and massive threat against us collectively as a species of people. The strongest and most powerful people on the planet and who's responsible for the building of the greatest civilizations the world has ever seen. And I'm afraid that I will have to continue fighting against this system of global white supremacy until it's time for me to leave this planet. And I will, even at that, I'm going to try to continue to set up something that will keep on fighting after I'm dead and gone. So I'm in agreement with what you're saying. Let me ask you this. In your opinion, do you think that the ministers in these churches are blocking the sisters from marriage to the brothers? Is anything like that going on? It may not.
I don't think it's a very big problem. It does exist. You know, one of the perks of being a minister is you get to cohabitate with so many other women, which is quite interesting because the black church is so adamant against polygamy, but nobody practices polygamy more than the black church. It's quite an ironic set of circumstances. I mean, we all know that many ministers and deacons use their privileged position, you know, to actually indulge in the women in the congregation, you know. And it ain't just Christianity. It's all of the different faiths that we have. But we need a thorough spiritual cleansing. We also need a thorough political cleansing. But let's be clear about something. All behavior is a function of the consequences. And if we want black ministers to change the way in which they are actually conducting business, if we want them to become more politically and race conscious, we're going to have to give them consequences. We're going to have to stop going to the church. We're going to have to stop giving them money. But as long as black people do not demand accountability, as long as black people do not demand accountability from their leaders, be they religious or secular, we're not going to be able to get anywhere because any person, it's within human nature to get over on people if they let you.
Okay, let me move on to the next point, and this is just an outright question. I want to deal with a war, and the reason why I'm going to deal with that is because I heard one time that Europeans said it was three things that they would never teach people of African descent, descent. And one thing is the science of warfare, the science of business, and the science of mating. Now, my question is a flat-out question. Should people of African descent inside the United States join the military of the United States?
No, they should not. No, they should not. Because all you're doing is fighting for the perpetuation and maintenance of white supremacy. It makes absolutely no sense. Why would you? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So, no, we totally should not be joining the military. And we fail to realize that when you do join the military, you know, they're not telling our young people that once you become a serviceman, it's going to be difficult for you to complete your college education. They offer them these GI bills and they offer them all this other nonsense, but nobody is telling them that if you do not go into the military without a degree, then you will be a grunt for the rest of your life. No one's telling them that. So a lot of our young people who feel hopeless about their future are going into the military thinking they're going to get the GI Bill and all this other stuff, and it never actually materializes. And if you also don't have an education going into the military, you almost always are certain to end up as a frontline infantry troop, which is nothing more than an expendable body. You know, you see brothers riding through the neighborhood with trucks, you know, infantry, United States military infantry, United States Army military. Infantry. Why are you advertising the fact that you are an expendable life for white supremacy? I'm totally against the military, but unfortunately with the No Child Left Behind Act, that gave the various branches of the armed service unprecedented access to student files in school so that they could effectively recruit for the military. So they are looking for the boy whose father is in jail. They are looking for the boy who drops out of school because they are looking for what? Bodies, expendable lives that they can use to put out on the front line and fight a war for white supremacy. And Colin Powell is actually the one who made JROTC in the high schools famous. One of his first responsibilities through the Department of Defense was to propagate the JROTC program in the inner city neighborhoods.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, I'm in agreement with that. Actually, I'm in agreement with everything that you've said so far. I've heard it before, and I just want to make sure that everybody that's out there listening to Dr. Umar Johnson understands the impact of what this brother is telling you. We're in a serious crisis inside the United States as a nation. And I'm looking at the situation collectively, and what we are up against is 9 points. These 9 points are economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. We're being attacked as a nation, as a species of people worldwide on all 9 of these points. This thing is just not isolated to the United States of America. It is worldwide. This is attack against the people of high concentrations of carbon, or what you're calling melanin, and we are being attacked by a small minority on the planet in the face of the majority of people of color. Now, there's a basic situation. If we look at this with just common sense, if a black man and a white woman come together, have a child, they're going to produce a child of color. If a white man gets with a black woman, they're going to have a child of color. Now, if a white man and a white woman get together, they will produce a white child. Now, if a black man and a black woman get together, they can produce every color in the spectrum. So you see, this particular species of fighting against what is called genetic annihilation. And the people who's producing the highest concentrations of what you're calling melanin is the biggest threat. Therefore, the threat is against these particular people in an all-out attack from every conceivable angle. They're attacking the children in the womb through eugenics. They're killing your children, your babies inside the clinics and inside of the hospital. Now, I just wanted to put that little bit of information out there. And for those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to the teachings of Dr. Umar Johnson, a psychologist, psychiatrist, and all of these things involving the mind and our children and our state as a nation. I would also like to add that the brother does have a website that you can go to and get this information that he's telling us about. You have it on DVD. And Brother Johnson, would you give us that information one more time?
Certainly. My website, drumarjohnson.com, D-R-U-M-A-R, johnson.com. My speaking calendar is there. I have a complete list of my DVD and audio products. You can email me what you like, and I'll send you a PayPal link. There's also articles there. There's YouTube clips there. It's a very interactive and useful site. You can also follow me on Facebook and on Twitter under Dr. Umar Ifatunde, Dr. Umar, I-F-A-T-U-N-D-E, Ifatunde, which is my Yoruba name, on Twitter, on Facebook, at Dr. Umar Ifatunde. But my name as well as my website is drumarjohnson.com.
Okay. Okay, so you can all go there. And he has an abundance of educational materials on DVD disc, and you can get this information, and you can start studying this stuff, because we need to arrange our priorities properly, because if we are unable to continue on as a species through the process of procreation and defend our children and protect them in the school system, and other places, then we have a serious plight inside this country. Dr. Johnson, let me go on to the next thing here. Can you tell us what should we be doing now as a people inside the United States in regards to economics?
Well, the one thing we need to be doing, every race of people can only be saved through a solid industrial and institutional foundation. You need institutions in order to serve the needs of your people, and you need industries in order to finance them. For example, we need schools. That's the institution. What is going to be the industry to finance the school? Okay? We need social services, after-school programs. We need homes for our elderly. We need therapeutic programs for women, the victims of domestic violence, for men who are going through their own personal issues, okay? And then you need an industry to finance it. You got to have institutions and industries. Because we have no industry, most of our institutions are 100% financed by the enemy, by the social order, by white philanthropy, by the federal, state, local government. You cannot save a people by being financed by the same person who you're trying to fight. It does not work. That's why we don't get anywhere. That's why when you look around, you see 1,001 community-based organizations, CBOs. You got organizations of women coming together because their sons were killed. Nothing wrong with that. You got organizations of men coming together because they want to do something for young males. There's nothing wrong with that. You got after-school programs. You got summer camps. You got this. You got that. But they are all financed by the same people you're fighting, which is why we haven't made any progress since the Civil Rights Movement, because we fail to recognize the painful fact, and that is you cannot advance your issue as long as you're being paid, as long as you're being financed by the enemy. Which is why the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey is the only black leader we had in the 20th century who never took a dollar from another race, absolutely never, not from an Arab, not from a white person, not from nobody. Marcus Garvey said that white membership in black organizations was like a cancer that eat away at black people's ability to do for themselves. White money is also a cancer. We have to learn to solve our problems ourselves. It's the only way to do it. By taking shortcuts, we have only been moving backwards to the future. All of these programs, all of these budgets, all of these grants, and we haven't got one day better than where we were in 1963.
Okay. All right. So that's the economic situation. So now let me go on to another phase of that. And because I know that prior to the turn of the century, according to statistics, 95 percent of so-called Americans were self-employed, but immediately after the turn of the century, 95% of America now works for 5%. In your opinion, involving labor, what should we start doing now? Because we have, you know, the reason I'm asking this question is because all too often when it comes to needing money, the first thing we do is we say, well, I got to go out and get a job. We never seem to think that we could create something of our own. So what is your take on labor inside the United States, and what should we be doing in regards to that?
Well, we got to recognize something. Black people are afraid, a lot of us, to actually try to go into business for ourselves. There's a fear associated with trying to survive on one's own. So a lot of us will simply get a job and be content in that job, never thinking about working for ourselves, because you can rely on that money. It's the same amount of money every 2 weeks. And so many of us would rather get paid that same miserable salary that we can trust than try to make more money on our own, because, you know, and take a risk not knowing where the next salary is going to come from. And so, unfortunately, because of that, that works against us developing significant amounts of capital, but it also works against us because we're working for white folk. And it's very difficult to get involved in any kind of political agitation when your salary is being paid for by your enemy. So a lot of black people tend not to struggle, or tend not to struggle as hard as we need them to, because they're being financed by the enemy. So when we look at self-employment, we can't purely look at it as a need of just working for yourself. We got to look at it for the political ramifications that it has. And when you work for yourself, no matter how little you're making, but when you're economically independent, you can say what you want, do what you want, okay, and go where you want. But when you are not economically independent, you are always concerned about where your bread and butter is going to come from tomorrow if you get fired by the white man today. So being self-employed is not just an option. It is a necessity for black people, because until we can speak freely, the reason I'm able to speak freely is because I'm self-employed. I work for myself, so I'm able to speak freely. And until we are able to speak freely, we're not going to be able to get very far.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have heard that. And I'm going to encourage you all to go back and re-listen to my broadcast that I've done on the pineal gland, and part one and part two. And that'll give you some, for those of you who have not listened to that, if you would, go and listen to that, and that will show you how to be creative. I'm going to give you an example of what I did once when I was employed. I got an apartment, and I formulated a plan, because I got tired of getting jobs and working and earning a fixed income. And for those of you who don't understand that, anytime you're working on a job and they determine how much they're going to pay you for an hour, that's amount to how much you're going to receive at the end of the week. So you're on that fixed income. And with the economic conditions and the fact that we're dealing with the fiat currency with no gold backing it, you still have a problem. So what I did was I formulated a plan to acquire seed capital for investment. So when I went to work, the first thing I wanted to know day one when I got at the job is how much overtime can I get, because I know that Monday through Friday I was working for the owners of the company. But when on my days off, that's my time. And I wanted to use that time to formulate, gain better control of my lifestyle so that I can stop working for other people and start providing jobs for other people. And I was successful. And today I am self-employed. And as a result of taking full responsibility for myself and using my time wisely and using the money for seed capital for investment. And I just wanted to put that out there for us. For those of you who are just tuning in, I'm offering my same articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed and the Commerce Game and How to Play. And there's another article about your children or whether you own them or the state own them. And you get that simply by contacting me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's T-A-R-H-A-K-A 99@yahoo.com, and I'll get that to you. And if you add a Facebook, a Twitter, a Black Planet, MySpace, just hit me up. If you're on Facebook, you can send me a friend request, and I'll go ahead and honor it. And that way you can go to our Tahakus Institute, and you can get a great deal of information there. You can go to Tahakus Moorish American Group, and we're teaching there by video. And Brother Umar Johnson's video is posted there on the regular, so you can listen to those as well and continue to get this information. We have created one of the most comprehensive libraries inside the United States, and the way to access that is simply by contacting me at area code 904-303-9061. And that library have hundreds of articles in it. And if you got children inside of your home, if you're trying to change your thinking patterns, it's very nice to have your own library that you can draw from. So we have created that for you. And you just simply contact me, and we can get it to you. Now, Brother Umar, I want to go back to this thing here involving slavery. Could you give us the extent of the psychological effects of slavery and what it has had on our people, and how is that manifesting itself today? Could you give us
very much so, very much so. Too often we focus on the daily life of a slave, and by focusing on the daily life of a slave, we fail to recognize the goal of slavery. The way to see whether or not you are still suffering from the same mental conditioning that you did under the whip is by seeing whether or not you still fulfill the objectives of slavery. For example, slavery taught black people not to trust one another. That's still with us. Number two, slavery taught black people to participate in their own self-destruction. We do that. Slavery taught black people to spend their money on having fun and to let their slave master provide for their needs. This way, the slave master would never be threatened by black folks using their money to work together. We still do the exact same thing. Slavery taught black people that white people were better and that to try to go against white people could cause you all sorts of punishments. And to this very day, we are still paranoid of white people and what they can do to us if we ever step out of line. So if you look at the basic teachings of slavery, you have to ask yourself, do black people still adhere to the core teachings of slavery? Yes, we most certainly do. Everything we look at, everything we do, most of our behavior can automatically reveal two inclinations in black people. One is a self-hatred, and two, a desire to be accepted by white people. Look at almost anything we do, entertainment, economics, take the non-core areas of human endeavor. Take black folks you see on the news. Take your entertainers. Everything we do is related to self-hatred and a desire to be accepted by white folks. Everything we do, from our choice of careers, where we live, who we marry, how we dress, how we talk, how we act, what we study in college, all of it, self-hatred, getting away from your people, white love, getting accepted by white people. Most of our children are taught that in school. The average black child is motivated to get away from his people and get accepted by white people. Get away from his people and get accepted by white people. That was the core teaching of slavery, and we still function under that belief system.
Okay. Well, Brother Johnson, what kind of setup do they have going on in the school system between the child and the teacher? Because I noticed that I find it difficult to understand how a white middle class female can teach a black male child. Could you shed some light on that?
Okay. A good teacher is like a good therapist. In order to effectively teach somebody, you have to care about them. If the child doesn't detect that the person teaching cares, they won't try. And so it's going to be difficult to teach when you don't care. Now, some people can still effectively teach even when they don't care because they're very strict and they're very stern teachers. But true education, which is to make a child love the desire to learn, is something that can only come from someone who generally cares about the child. Listen to me clearly, and I want everybody on your show to hear me. I don't care what they change about public education. I don't care if they give the schools more money. I don't care if they reduce class sizes. I don't care if every black parent suddenly becomes totally involved in their child's education. I don't care if they redo the school buildings. I don't care if every teacher gets a better education in college. I don't care what they do to change public schools. They could pay the teachers more money. It don't matter. Spend more money per child. It don't matter. As long as the success of black boys is contingent upon the instructional effectiveness of middle-class white women, the miseducation will always continue. That is the crux of your problem. White women who don't care about the black boys they teach in. Until you do something about that, nothing else you do will make a damn difference.
Okay. So, well, those of us who have our children in the public schools, is there any type of alternative situation that we can do? I know that we should have our own schools, and
right.
But is there anything else that we can do immediately to address that situation?
Immediately, well, you can supplement your child's education. You know, people often say, you know, what are we going to do because there's really no good schools out here. Okay, what you do is you supplement your child's education. See, we got to stop being lazy and expecting the schools to do everything. Most of them don't do anything. So if you want your child to be properly educated, you're going to have to supplement the school. Find out what your child isn't getting, and you give it to them yourself. That's what we have to do. A lot of black people are homeschooling these days. Homeschooling is also a viable opportunity if you have the resources and time to homeschool. Many of us have to work 2 and 3 jobs, so how can we possibly homeschool? So you got to be realistic about the homeschool option, because I've seen black people homeschool their children only to turn around and see that the child received the worst education because the parent didn't have time for their children. We have to go to private schools. We have to pool our money together and go to private schools. I mean, right now, we're in the midst of the Hollywood shopping season, Christmas, Kwanzaa, and New Year's. Black people are going to hemorrhage billions of dollars on Christmas, Kwanzaa, and New Year's spending. If we only took that money, we could build an independent school for every black boy in America if we cared. The truth of the matter is we don't really care about our children as much as we claim, and white people know it. White people know that if black people really love their children, not individually, but collectively, they know that if black people really love their children, they would have their own schools. See, when you hate yourself, your self-hatred is not limited to yourself. It extends to every member of your community and every member of your family. And that is why black men and black women are constantly fighting at each other's throats, because it's a symptom of self-hatred. And it's also why our boys are catching hell in public school every day, because their black communities don't care enough about them to give them an independent learning experience.
Okay. Now, well, let me ask you this. What can we start doing now to eliminate or eradicate this health self-hate thing that we're suffering from?
Okay. In psychology, when you're trained in therapy, as I am, I'm a nationally certified school psychologist. My doctorate is in clinical psychology, and I'm also an educator and political scientist. Those are my 4 social sciences in which I'm trained. But in therapy, you're taught to assess the patient's willingness and ability to change. From your first day of therapy, you're studying your client to see whether or not you believe they possess the desire to change and whether they possess the resources, the psychological resources to change, because change is not easy, okay? And when I look at black people, when I look at the psyche and the mindset of black people, I have to be brutally honest, and I'm looking at a people who really do not want to change, who like being exactly who and what they are. So in order for us to get out of this post-traumatic slavery hypnosis that we're under, my brother, we're going to have to properly educate an entire generation of black children. That's the only way to get this done. We cannot keep trying to fix psychologically damaged adults. We don't give up on them. We continue to fight. But the bulk of our time, energy, and resources should be spent on black children who have not yet been hypnotized under the spell of white supremacy. If we could take every newborn black boy or girl and properly educate them in a residential academy far away from the negative influences and self-hating behaviors and habits of their parents, family, and friends, and subject them to a rigorous African-centered political, and economically based private education where they're given culture as well as consciousness. From birth to age 21, we would have a new race in about 50 years. We wouldn't even be having this discussion because black children wouldn't have any other option except building for themselves. They wouldn't have any other option except fighting white supremacy. They wouldn't understand what it means to be oppressed. They wouldn't even understand what post-traumatic slavery disorder meant because it is so foreign to them because we refuse to allow those types of poisons to intoxicate their souls. So that's what we need to do. In order to fix this, we have to fix education, which means the school is the most revolutionary investment. It is the most revolutionary undertaking. It is the most revolutionary institution that we can all collectively participate in. If you want to fix the race, fix the education system. But you cannot keep trying to fix the people who have been permanently damaged through public schooling.
Okay. All right. So that would mean that we're going to have to prioritize some time in our homes as an immediate situation and begin to work with our children and ourselves to gain what I call a Afrocentric consciousness. And that was one of my main reasons for creating the library that I created, because it contains tons of information on our story and stuff that we need to know to maintain a consciousness of from a African position. I also am very, very careful about what I watch on television. Most of what I look on television is what I put there. I don't look at regular programming. I look at listen to my DVD disc and education materials on a regular basis when I'm actually looking at it. But we're going to have to change our mindset, and we're going to have to deal with our children, because I learned a long time ago that the human brain is just like a bucket of water with a hole in it. You have to keep putting worthwhile information because it continues to leak out. And I don't see in the school system today where they are teaching our culture and our story. And to me, that is an attack in itself. And I know when I was in school, there was very, very little of it taught then. So I'm pretty sure that it's not a whole lot very deep and detailed information that we need to know as people of African descent that we can put into the minds of our children. We got approximately over 20 minutes to go. So, Brother Johnson, if you would, I'm going to run a short clip that I've taken from one of your things, and I want to play this for the listening audience, and then we'll come back and get back on course.
Indeed.
The most dangerous thing in the life of black people, second only to white racism, is elitist blacks. Elitist blacks are largely responsible for the lack of progress in the current quality of life that is exercised by the black masses. Elitist blacks are some ministers, some imams, some religious leaders, some business owners, some politicians, some community leaders, some college graduates who position themselves in relation to the power structure and sustain their existence in that relationship with the power structure by exploiting, misrepresenting, and misleading the black masses. Members of the black elite often have the same opinions and viewpoints towards the black masses as white people do. They are almost white people in black faces. They have the same ambitions, the same goals. They are just as capitalist-minded. They are just as interested in moving out of their neighborhoods or not supporting people in their neighborhoods. They treat black children just as poorly and meanly as any white racist or white elite would do. Black masses are the biggest reason for our lack of progress. Because what the black masses, the black elite are the biggest reason for the lack of progress on part of the black masses. What they do is they set themselves up as leaders for the black masses. So what you have are Negroes who don't like black people, but who lead black people. These are the people who are so quick to be appointed into government positions that are of influence to the black community and give off the false belief or notion that they are actually there to do some good for the black people, and they are not. One of the reasons why black people haven't made much progress since the Civil Rights Bill of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 is because the leadership that has taken over since the assassination of Dr. King, Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X has been a black elitist leadership. Some people call black elitists bourgeois. Although sometimes I use that term, I try not to use it too much because they're really not black bourgeois. Because a bourgeoisie, which is a Marxist concept, is someone who owns a certain degree of wealth. Members of the black elite don't really have a lot of wealth. They have some. But the black elite does not equal the upper middle class white bourgeoisie who they are often compared to. They have cash, not wealth. White bourgeoisie has wealth. Black elites have cash. They have more money and influence, but they don't have the type of wealth that middle class and upper class whites have. But these black elitists, your civil rights leaders and ministers, they don't do anything of consequence to help black people. All they do is feed off of black people's emotions. They feed off of black people's values. These are the folks who will set up a church in a poor black neighborhood and do nothing for the people in that neighborhood, although they extract hundreds of thousands of dollars from that community. These are people who will become principal at a school or start their own school or run for public office, never doing anything of consequence to help the blacks. All they do is help themselves at the expense of black people. See, what black elites operate in a clique. If you want to be a member of the black elite, you have to join. You have to become a Mason or join a certain fraternity, or you have to be born into the black elitist club by virtue of your parentage or by virtue of who your mentor was in the community. But you must be nominated and brought in. Not anyone is allowed to be within the black elitist structure. Now, me personally, I could join the black elites if I wanted to, but I'm not interested in it. I have the training, the schooling, the accolades, but I'm not interested because to join the black elite, to become a member of that parasitic group, is to automatically turn your back on black people. Most of your politicians are black elitists. Most of your civil rights leaders are black elitists. Most of your clergymen, not just Christian, but Islamic, Buddhist, Hebrew, I don't care what it is, most of the leaders are members of the black elite. They might seem like they represent different factions of the community, but at the end of the day, they come together in secret and in private, and they meet amongst themselves. The black elites are the biggest problem that black people have, because these are the people who misdirect your energy. They tell you that Barack Obama is doing a good job for you, even though he's done nothing. They tell you to vote for Barack Obama, even though they don't have the slightest idea what he's going to do for black people once they get in. Why do they do this? They tell you to vote for certain people for mayor and vote for certain people for governor, and they tell you not to get upset at the police when they brutalize black people. These are the people who are very careful about their words. They don't say too much when white racism strikes because they have a relationship with the white racist structure. They can't go to war with white racism because they have a relationship with the white racist. So their job is to do what? Calm you down so you don't force them to do the job that they should be doing in the first place. Every time you meet a black person, particularly if they are so-called middle class or well-educated, if they're a politician or civil rights leader or a religious leader, you want to ask yourself, is this person representing me, or are they simply controlling me in the interest of white racism and supremacy so they can carve out a niche of existence for themselves? A good book to read would be E. Franklin Frazier's Black Bourgeoisie, Nathan and Julia Hare's The Black Anglo-Saxons. I'm also going to be penning a book on black elitists, because black elitists have to be getting out of the way. Black elitists are largely responsible, okay, for the death and incarceration of many of our black leaders. For example, if we look at the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey as an example, it was black elitist A. Philip Randolph and black elitist W.E.B. Du Bois who helped create the atmosphere that allowed the United States government to bring Mr. Garvey up on false charges, imprison him, and ultimately deport him. I'm not saying that black elitists don't do a little bit of good, but the good that they do is almost inconsequential when we look at the lack of action that they take. Every black person has to make a decision. Every black person. Either you are going to fight white racism and fight white supremacy, or you are going to aid, abet, support, and accommodate. Every black person has to make that decision. You're either going to ignore white supremacy, which means that you are supporting it by neglect, okay? Or you're going to fight white supremacy. Black elitists do not fight white supremacy. They simply bargain with white supremacy. They reason with white supremacy. They come to certain types of agreements with white supremacy, but they're not trying to bash white supremacy because they themselves are white supremacists in black faith.
Okay. I just wanted to get that clip. I thought that was very, very interesting, and I had listened to it several times. And that's setting me up for the next question that I had for you. We have approximately 13 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure, excuse me, that I get that in. Now, my question is, should people of African descent participate in the political arena? Should they not?
Okay. When you study electoral politics, the key thing you learn is that people get into politics to protect what they already have. They get into politics to protect or expand what they already have. If you look at the Supreme Court, everyone on the Supreme Court is a millionaire. You look at United States Congress, everyone in Congress is a millionaire. You look at the president, every president has been a millionaire, including President Obama, who's worth several million dollars. So people don't get into politics to try to get. They get into politics to try to protect or expand what they already have. Now, strategically speaking, you can use electoral politics as one strategy amongst many to advance your cause. The problem is we are taught, brainwashed into believing that electoral politics is the be-all and end-all of black struggle. In other words, you don't need to do anything else except vote in order to change your condition. It is the worst message that black people have been taught by black bourgeoisie as well as by the American social order. To vote is revolutionary. So black people voting for President Obama, they compared that to the March on Washington. They compared that to the Dr. King Montgomery bus boycott. They compared that to the Garvey movement. They compared that to what Malcolm was doing. Okay? That has nothing to do with that. Electoral politics will never change anything if you use it by itself. It must be coupled with other strategies. Remember, every law, every change that black people have gotten in this society, they did not get it through the vote. Nothing significant that you have received has been had by a vote. You didn't get your freedom from a vote. You didn't get the Civil Rights Bill by a vote. You didn't get the Voting Rights Act by a vote. Everything you got through what? Protest and agitation. Everything. There's not one significant piece of legislation or change in black existence since slavery that we got through voting. Voting has never, ever been a major avenue of change for black people. And it never will be. Grassroots street protest, agitation, and struggle. That's how we got where we are.
If you want to use voting as a strategy on the local or state level, so be it. You can use it as a strategy to put pressure on elected officials to do what they should be doing and haven't been doing for decades. I have no problem with that as a strategy. But if you want to sell voting like a religion, as they've been doing to black people, making you religiously believe that you're going to change something just through voting, then you're being hoodwinked. Most importantly, we got to recognize that the black vote will never count for anything anyway unless it is organized and locked together. Until you have dozens, hundreds, tens of thousands of black votes all going for the same candidate at the same time, it won't matter anyway. Our vote is too disorganized. Even when we vote, we disorganize. You got 50,000 blacks going Democrat, 50,000 blacks going Republican, 50,000 blacks going Green Party, 50,000 blacks going independent. And so you get nowhere because the votes are not organized. Remember, in a democracy, the minority is always at the mercy of a majority. In the democracy, the majority rules. So with black people being 12 to 17% of the United States population, how in the hell are you going to decide the outcome of anything as a minority? You can't. So the way you make your influence felt is by locking your votes together and using it as a bargaining rod, and you put your votes before both major parties, and you ask, what are you going to do for me if I do this for you? And if you don't deliver on what you said, the same 40 million black votes that put your ass in office is going to take your ass out of office. That's the only way we're going to get stuff done. They keep telling black people that they made a difference because they got out and vote. How the hell can a disorganized schizophrenic vote mean anything to anybody? That's another great myth that's been pushed on our people.
Okay. All right. Now, let me ask you this. I noticed that in a lot of cases where there's upheavals in the land and where there's demonstrations and rioting and stuff, this brother Al Sharpton shows up. And I mean, people like him show up and try to. And I never understood, you know, where he came from. Could you share some light on those type brothers?
Well, here's the thing. Most black leaders today are opportunists. They only show up when it's something in it for them. Most of these guys won't even come and help you unless you pay them. I know this for a fact. When you find out that Sharpton or somebody else was at a community organization, you know that somebody paid for it most of the time. They don't do anything for free. Black leadership is a business for them. It's a business. Just like you might sell sneakers or have your own dry cleaners, or you might sell whatever you do. Black leadership, for most black leaders, it is a business. It is a way of living off the people. It is not about making any change. And I was very disappointed in Reverend Sharpton, not that I really trusted that he was serious anyway, but when he prostituted himself before the federal branch of the government, as he has done and continues to do with this Obama presidency, you know, I've lost all respect for the man. No black leader can afford to endorse a president and approve of everything he does, including neglect his own people. When Sharpton did that, he lost my respect. I lost a lot of respect for that man. I didn't have much to begin with, but once he done that, that was the last straw for me. But the problem is what? Accountability. We don't hold these people accountable. We let people sell us out, come back, and they could be our leaders again. That is absolutely ridiculous. You're not supposed to let somebody like that come right back into your community after he's been selling you out for 3 years under Obama. President Obama is no longer president, Al Sharpton will go right back to the hood from where he come from and start acting like he's a black leader again after he done sold out. Why? Because we don't hold him accountable. So you have to ask yourself, who's at fault? Is it the leader or is it the people who keep following him?
Okay. I always see the brother show up, and he's always there. He's always giving the speech, but I never see anything positive happen as a result of him being there. And I mean, I don't really know the brother, but I'm just wondering. I was just wondering, who is he? Where did he come from? You know, and what's going on with him? So I just thought I'd ask that because I know you travel, and I figure maybe you knew more about it than I do, because I don't watch regular TV a lot, and I definitely don't look at what they're calling news at all. Now, I have on occasion listened to Brother Tevin Smiley.
Okay.
But I stopped. Do you know that, brother?
Oh, I'm familiar with both of them. I mean, they all basically come in the same vein. You know, there's not much difference between those guys. Most of them are all opportunists. Most of them just simply are looking for a way to get paid off the black struggle without really doing anything for black people. You know, Al Sharpton has never really put himself on the line for black people. Tavis Smiley, Cornel West, Michael Eric Dyson, these guys are all bourgeoisies. They act like they're leaders, but they're really just bourgeoisies. Their hustle is the people. Their hustle is the people. What have they done of significance for black people? Nothing. They just talk about your problem. Talk about your problem. Have a radio show. Talk about your problem. Has Al Sharpton, has Tavis Smiley, has Cornel West, has Michael Eric Dyson, when have they ever held a community meeting to seriously organize black people to bring about change? When have you seen it? You never have. So if y'all care about black people so much, why haven't y'all started organizing us yet? Who's sincere, because the sincere people are always about organizing people. The sincere people are always about organizing people. Why haven't they began organizing us? Why? Because they're not interested in the black struggle. They're only interested in making pennies and cents off the black struggle. You know the serious leader when he starts talking organization. Not just talking, but speaking and walking organization. Minister Farrakhan, he's not organizing black people. Jesse Jackson, he's not organizing black people. Al Sharpton, he's not organizing black people. Who in the country with national prominence is actively organizing black people? Give me one name, because I don't know of one. They're not. They're living off the people. They're not living for the people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We only have a couple of minutes left. And I just want to say I certainly appreciate you coming on to my radio show, and so that we could get this information out. And I'm definitely looking forward to you returning to Jacksonville, so that you can provide us with more information. And I noticed that as time go on, you always bring the latest thing that's going on, especially inside the school system and with the pharmaceutical industry and the stuff that they are putting on our children. And I just want to say I thank you for that, and I really appreciate you being here. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been listening to Dr. Umar Johnson, a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and I do view you as both, my brother. I hope that's all right, because you have dropped a tremendous amount of information, and it's been very, very informative and very, very helpful on YouTube, on this radio broadcast, and others, as well as in personal appearance all over the United States. And right now the clock on the wall says that's all, and so I want to encourage you in the future, if you would come back, and so that we can do another broadcast. I will certainly appreciate it when time permits, because I know that you are a very busy man. And in the future, I will be calling on you. But until next time, I've been your host, ladies and gentlemen, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and you all have a good night.
Indeed. Peace and love.